This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Popcorn Culture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, joined as always by Shamila Ganesan and Arvin Yuvaraj. We've got a pretty exciting lineup for you this week. It's all science fiction all the time, and we are starting with a throwback to what has been widely regarded, and I'm inclined to agree, as one of the best science fiction films ever, and that is Blade Runner. So to clarify, not Blade Runner 2049, but the Blade Runner that was supposed to have taken place in 2019 that was in fact released in 1982.
I feel like I've been waiting ever since we started the show to be able to talk about Blade Runner. So it's finally here and I'm so excited. I've watched this movie so many times and I think it's a testament to how great it is and how well it does science fiction, that each time I watch it, it feels fresh. Each time I watch it, it still feels like people should learn how to make science fiction from watching Blade Runner.
Which is kind of amazing, because I'm still amazed that it actually flopped when it first came out. And I think about that every time I watch this movie, like, how is this not the biggest blockbuster of 1982 when it started showing, right? Like, what kind of benchmarks and what kind of standards did people in the 80s have? Like, they just looked at this and went, no, you know, I'll give it a pass. You know, it's not that cool. Like, they had janky CGI back then. Like, they had to use actual imagination to make the stuff look real. And they still gave this thing a pass. They still went like, it's not my thing. Never mind. Why?
It's so interesting, right? Because the reputation of Blade Runner is pretty late to the game. It's only after it was first released that it has been reassessed, that it's been looked at again, critically reevaluated. And so the story, such as it is that Harrison Ford plays Rick Deckard, or just Deckard as he's known throughout the film, someone who is a cop in charge of looking for replicants, who are androids that have been engineered to such a degree that they are virtually indistinguishable from humans, except that they are better and superior to us in every way. And they have also been responsible for wreaking some violence. They've come back down to Earth from being, what's the term that they use? Off-planet? And so he just has to hunt down this gang of replicants, and in so doing kind of gets embroiled in a larger philosophical struggle about what it means to be human and what it means to die.
Well, all of those might explain why it was such a hard sell to the audience in 1982. But I also wanted to point out that, of course, 1982, the version was also different, right? Because this movie famously has also gone through one theatrical release, then there was a different cut, and then there was a final cut. And so depending on which version you first watched, I think how you think of the movie and the impact you carry away with it also makes a really big difference. It is also adapted from one of the best known writers of science fiction. It was based on Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? So that's another sort of geeky thing there. I think the reason this works so well is actually those philosophical questions. The sci-fi part of it, especially in today's world, I feel like we've gotten a little closer to many of the things that they talk about. I mean, it's set in 2019, and some of those things feel very familiar now. But I think that question at the heart of it, what actually makes us human, but also the question of what does it mean to to die, for life to end. And I think those things are universal questions, and that's what makes Blade Runner so impactful even today.
So I wonder if those are the things that made Ridley Scott have like 7 different cuts of this film, because it's huge, right? It's not something that you can tell in like a single 120 minutes or 1 hour 45 minutes or however long the movie was. And he's like, he loves asking these questions. He keeps asking these questions even today. And I don't know if, you know, he couldn't pack all of what he wanted to say into the first version, the theatrical release. So he went back and changed it. Then he changed it again and again and again. And I still cannot tell the versions apart. Like, I will start watching a version and something new will suddenly pop up that makes me realize like, oh, I've never seen this cut before. Like, it's a brand new thing. And I honestly don't know how many different cuts are floating around out there for people to watch, and if anyone has actually seen all 7 versions of Blade Runner.
Yeah. It's also worth pointing out that Ridley Scott didn't even have full control over all those versions. He had full control over like 3 maybe. I know that sounds like a lot in and of itself, but when you know that there were maybe 7 floating about at any given point, depending on when you watched the film, depending on even which DVD you might have picked up in the store, then you understand that I think this is a really good example of a movie in which sometimes, if you have a filmmaker you trust, and at the time, Ridley Scott wasn't the name that he is today, so that's the other thing. But if you have a filmmaker whose vision you trust, who you want to carry through, maybe you leave the guy alone, because a lot of the insertions, I think, into some other versions actually make the film worse, because part of the film's appeal, at least for me, is its ambiguity. It doesn't want to show its hand at any point. It doesn't want to say with any certainty that humans are better, replicants are better, or if even that this character is or isn't a replicant. And the fact that it withholds all that is part of what makes it great. And when you insert a Hollywood happy ending, when you insert, you know, voiceovers that Harrison Ford himself famously really, really hated, I think it does detract from some of the versions. The story itself has such good bones, but you can get it wrong. And I think some of the versions do get it wrong.
Absolutely. In fact, I really don't like the original theatrical version, which was made I really don't like is really overstating it, because it's still got a great story. But the things that it had, which were made to make it more audience friendly, a happy ending, the voiceover, as you said, Lynn, all of these things only serve to make it feel a little bit like it's pandering to the audience. Whereas the version that I think I've watched the most number of times, and the one that I watched for this review, is the final cut, which is, you know, as close to Ridley Scott's vision as you'll probably get. Yes, there is this beautiful melancholy to the film, which does well without Harrison Ford's grumpy voiceover. And I think it really emphasizes the story. And it also serves to, I think, leave you with that kind of mystery that lingers a lot longer. Beyond the cool sci-fi element, the existential feeling of it is something that comes through much more in this particular cut.
But at the same time, you're not actually sure who the story is centering around. Like, on the surface, it's supposed to be about Deckard looking for these like rogue replicants, right? Because they've started to sort of ponder on their own existence, kind of. But the story is a lot about Deckard as well, even though it never really tells you that it's about Deckard. So they're like clues. It's all in like the lighting, and it's like it happens in brief seconds. And if you catch it, you do. And if you don't, you don't.
It's a pretty classic noir move, right? To have a sort of rumpled detective, somebody who's burnt out, somebody who's just kind of over it all, and being pulled back in for one last score, which is part of the storyline, right? Like, if you take away the science fiction trappings, if you take away the skin jobs and the flying cars and the buildings and all the rest of it, then you can appreciate also as a noir detective story, which it is. And it's lit that way. It's shot that way as well. But I think also, part of the reason why that's the case, and maybe why Harrison Ford wasn't the main focus, even though he's such an important character, is because you have Roy Batty, who is such a charismatic presence, right? Rutger Hauer just does the thing, you know? He's the leader of the replicants, of course. And you need to have somebody like that in the adversarial point of view for you to even have the kind of sympathy that you need to have for the replicants in order for the story to work.
See, I don't think people anticipated how big a deal Rutger Hauer would be to this film, because so much of what has become the cornerstones of what we remember of Blade Runner came about because of his ideas that weren't even in the script, from this great monologue at the end that everyone quotes from, to bits of poetry that he throws in, the physicality that he brings to the role. And even I think he's actually more human in many scenes than Deckard, who is supposed to be our sort of human into this whole story. And I completely agree. I actually think when you come away from the film, you it's great that you're wondering who the story actually is about. Is it about Roy Batty, who's Rutger Hauer's character? Or is it about Deckard? Or is it some sort of juxtaposition between the two of them? Who are you supposed to empathize with? I must say that for me, each time I watch it, I start off being a Deckard person. And by the time the movie ends, I'm so completely empathizing with Roy that it's a journey. And I love that about this film.
We're talking today about 1982's Blade Runner, which was directed by Ridley Scott, produced by Michael Dealey, written by Hampton Fancher and David Peoples, and of course, starring all the people that we've just spoken about, Harrison Ford, Rutger Hauer, and as yet, we've not actually talked about Sean Young. So we are going to be continuing this conversation. In the meantime, let us know, did you watch Blade Runner back in the day? Have you always enjoyed it? Do you love it? What do you make of the sequel, even? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can, of course, also tweet us at BFM Radio.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Hi everyone, you are listening still to Popcorn Culture with Lynn Sharmilan Arvin, and today, because it is science fiction week here on Popcorn Culture, apropos of nothing really, we are talking about Blade Runner, the original one in 1982. And I just wanted to say one thing before we can kind of branch out and talk about other stuff, and that is, which side of the debate do you land on? Because this movie famously has a disagreement at the very heart of it. Harrison Ford and Ridley Scott fundamentally disagree about their central character. They don't agree on whether or not Deckard is a human, to put it simply. And I love the fact that the movie gives you enough information for both to be true, and that it has the strength of character to kind of stick that landing. Do you guys have a horse in this race?
I'm going to give you a really cop-out answer. It changes every time I watch it. And I actually think that's why I love rewatching this movie so many times. Every time I watch it, I'll follow one particular thread. I'll look at one particular like nod that Deckard gives at a certain point, and I go, oh, yeah, he's realized it. He's not human. But then I'll watch it like a few years later and I'll be like, no, what was I thinking? He's clearly human. So I still don't know. And I think that's part of the joy of the film for me.
So we're confining this debate to just Blade Runner, right? We're going to assume we haven't seen 2049.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go.
Okay, yeah. I think he suspects it. That's my cop-out answer. I think he suspects it. I don't think he knows for sure. Or in true Harrison Ford sense, he's in complete denial. Yeah, that's a better way of putting it. He's in complete denial, even though he knows exactly what's going on.
So I just wanted to get that out of the way, because I truly believe that one of the best parts of the movie is that for the better part of over 30 years now, close to 40 years, they have refused to land one way or the next. And for that matter, the two of them continue to disagree publicly sometimes to this day. And I just love the idea that the debate continues.
But what do you think?
Oh, yeah. So after this particular watch, I thought that he was a replicant. But my favorite version is where it could go either way, because that's the best bit. The idea that you don't know in the same way that he doesn't know and perhaps doesn't want to know is part of what makes the movie work the way it does, I think. But yesterday I came away from it, admittedly from the final cut, which is the Ridley Scott cut, which is why he has the last word on it. I came away thinking that he's a replicant, but yeah. Okay, I think we need to talk about the character of Rachel, because Rachel, in the same way as Roy Batty, raises this question of what it means to be, what it means to be real and what it means to feel, because she has memories that she is not aware are not hers and is therefore completely convinced of her own humanity, even though the people who made her know better. And she's also the femme fatale of the piece. And I think, I don't know, she's interesting. I had a very different perception of her this time around than when I first watched it.
I actually love her sort of in contrast to Pris, who is the other female, the other female android that's in the film the most, and played by Daryl Hannah, because they're both so different. They represent very specific female tropes, I want to say, but they're both different. One is sort of out there and slightly crazy and a little scary in many scenes, and that's Pris, of course. And Rachel, on the other hand, is a much more what you'd expect a traditional love interest, quote unquote, to be. And I think both of these together do a lot in terms of what that means to. To me, at least, they represent what the difference between knowing what you are and not knowing what you are.
Rachel's the scariest character in this movie for me. Like, every time she shows up, especially like after the halfway mark, when they really get into, like, you know, who she is and what she is and realizing what she is, that part always opens up some sort of like existential crisis, because she's the closest to the human question, even though she's not human. And you know she's not human from the start. You know that she's an android or replicant. But yeah, whenever they open up like her story is the time when you get into like Truman Show stuff and like, you know, what are we really doing here? And what do our memories mean? And, you know, what is all this for? You know what I mean?
I was completely, you know, when I was rewatching it, I was like, oh my God, how would I know? How would I know if my
exactly,
memories,
exactly.
Yeah. And I think she's meant to be that for both us and also for Deckard.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. So she's the reason why he starts questioning himself and stuff. But I feel like if you had to choose a character to latch onto to really get what Ridley Scott is trying to say with this film, Rachel would be it. Even though the others are like louder, bigger characters, she's the one that has all the questions and none of the answers.
I wanted to finish, perhaps, or we don't have to finish, but I wanted to have a brief interlude to the behind-the-scenes stuff on Blade Runner, because that's as interesting as anything else. It was a very fraught set. I think watching the film, again, as an adult and knowing what you know, you understand why the filming was difficult. I mean, they're wet all the time and they were shooting like at night constantly. You know, the classic Blade Runner thing is like you stand in the rain and then at some point your hand goes through a wall. And that's not fun to shoot. I get that. So famously, you know, it was a fraught set. People on the set were arguing. There was a T-shirt war, I think, between the crew and their director. The director and his investors were also kind of squabbling. And I bring all this up because I think sometimes we have an idealized version of what filmmaking is supposed to be, where it's like the friend set. Everybody just gets along and it's great. And then you come together and you create this great thing. And I'm not here to stand in argument of the genius trope, but I also love the fact that you can have a very fraught, fractious set full of disagreements, and that's why maybe you come up with a film with this much ambiguity.
So I think I've said this before, but I often find that when you hear things like that, you realize how accidental some of these products end up being, because Blade Runner could have been a mess. It could have been a huge mess that nobody wanted to watch, but it wasn't. It turned out this brilliant and this lasting. And sometimes I don't understand. Is that what you call sort of creative lightning in a bottle? Is that just serendipity, everything falling together? Or is there some sort of genius in place that despite all of that chaos, something this great actually comes up? I don't know. And I think maybe a part of me likes not knowing and likes hearing these like odd stories and then wondering, how did that end up working?
I guess if it's the more difficult it is, the better the movie will be. But then that's also not true, because then you get really bad movies that have been like difficult productions and stuff. So I don't know, maybe it's about trusting the right people. I think, and obviously they didn't know how good Ridley Scott was going to be back then, because he had only done like a few films. But I guess just trusting in someone's vision and then like banding together and making that vision work. There must have been something that he proposed that everyone believed in. Maybe it was the physical sets or the big storylines or the big themes or the book that the movie was based on. I don't know, but I think at the end of the day, it has to be that, right? If you hate each other, you have to come together for someone. I want to believe that Ridley Scott was that someone, because otherwise, how would a production function without the lead guy, right?
I also think that before we close off and we just have like a minute, we haven't actually talked about how the movie looks or its music. And that's kind of crazy. Yes. And maybe a testament to how rich the text itself is, right? But I mean, the way that this movie looks really set the template for how so many other science fiction movies would follow suit in imagining what the world would look like. A little bit broken, a little bit decayed, recognizable, but also so cool and so interesting and so strange. And then that coupled with the music, coupled with the wardrobe, is just insane. I think that part of why the movie works as immediately as it does is because visually it's all there.
Oh, the tactility and the lived-in quality of this entire film, it makes me long for the days when sci-fi looked like this. I think increasingly sci-fi is imagined as a genre that feels very remote and removed and not part of our world. Blade Runner works because you can imagine that this is what our current world would look like in the future. And the handmade sets, the lack of actual CGI, looking at people wearing tweed and knowing what it would feel like on your skin. I think all of these things, there's so much thought put into how this film looks.
I mean, you take all of the way it looks and then you put like Vangelis in the background and then it just works. Vangelis is, I think, one of the main characters of this film because they tried to do something else with 2049 with Hans Zimmer. And Hans Zimmer is like one of probably the best working composer today, but it wasn't even close to Vangelis' score. And the stuff that he does, the way he sort of bleeds into the story itself and the way he composes so subtly but so melancholic and weirdly synthy and just signature in that Blade Runner way, it's like amazing. Also, coming back to the way it looks, just not focusing so much on the big, like, you know, the monolith, the structures and the architecture and stuff, but just letting it be in the background instead of focusing on it, that was like restraint. So that is like also so tactful. I honestly don't know if any other movie or any other Blade Runner sequel is gonna capture that sort of that feel that the original Blade Runner had.
I just don't think so. I mean, they might get more and more immense, more and more beautiful, more and more ambitious, but I don't know if anything will ever top Blade Runner in 1982. Let us know if you agree or disagree. Do you love Blade Runner? Do you hate Blade Runner? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.